Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT. Bandwidth for Floss Weekly is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com. This is Floss Weekly with Randall Schwartz, episode 66 for April 25th, 2009. Olay Nepal. Floss Weekly is brought to you by the 2009 Google Summer of Code Project. The Google Open Source Program has announced the student projects they accepted for 2009, and their students are now busy coordinating with their mentor organizations and getting their code work underway. Get involved in the open source community at code.google.com/SOC and tell them you heard about it on Floss Weekly. It's time for Floss Weekly. Leo Laporte here, Randall Schwartz there at his summer estate in beautiful Portland, Oregon.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, Randall.
And it's warm here, actually. We've had, the last couple of days have been 80 degrees, which is insane in April. We aren't supposed to have that kind of temperature this early in the year.
It's been the same here. It's been really sweaty and sweltery.
But you know what that means? That means that during Rose Festival at the end of May, we're just going to have constant rain. So we're all pretty prepared for that. That's usually how it works out.
So let me ask you, what are we going to do today that's going to be different? Something exciting, something fun.
Something very cool. This, I am really excited by the conversation today. It's, I was approached about a month ago from the guy who is, not just the guy, let's say Brian Berry, let's actually say his name, who is the technical director of the OLE Nepal. That's the online open learning exchange of Nepal. And this is the country Nepal. So this is
wow.
Like halfway around the world.
Yeah.
What Brian Berry and his cohorts have done is they have established a channel for the one laptop per child, the OLPC-XO, to be delivered into the student environment there. They started with a project, as you'll hear, they started with a project of just having like 20 or 30 units, and they're rolling out, as of this month, 2,500 OLPC-XOs all across Nepal. Very amazing conversation. Very, very smart guy. And he said, please, please interview me because it's timing. You know, we're trying to get this, we're doing this. So I went, yeah, great. So I a great interview. Yes.
One laptop per child is very cool. Are they still with the original version one of the OLPC?
I believe the XO is still the XO. They are changing the software slowly on it. There's been some new updates to, I think, what's called Sugar, the sort of base OS.
Sugar's the UI on top of it. But it's got Squeak on it, right?
It does have Squeak on it. It has a bunch of other activities on there. The thing I really like about the XO is that it's really designed for community, for classroom use.
Because it's got mesh built into it.
As these things wake up, they try to figure out, are there any other ones around?
Yeah.
And that's really nice. It's very cool. So that means there's two students can take these home and use them with each other and share data at home. It doesn't need the access point.
And only one of them needs internet access. The other neat thing about, if you want to get online, of course, yes, you're right, they could share data back and forth without internet access.
Right, and the kind of cooperation is very useful. Yeah.
This was originally going to be that $100 computer. I think it ended up costing a little bit more. But it's about the size and form factor of a netbook. In fact, this kind of came out when netbooks were big. But boy, is it loaded. I mean, you've got two USB ports, you've got a camera, you've got stereo speakers. It even has kind of a e-book mode where you can flatten it out. It's got the mesh. I mean, it's really, there's a lot to be said for this. I think it's a very cool system. It's not a netbook in the same. I mean, it's got a membrane keyboard. It's not running Windows. It's running, as I said, Linux with the Sugar on top. I think it's a Linux kernel with sugar on top.
Yes, Linux kernel with sugar running. Yes, exactly. But the nice thing is that, you know, the keys may be a little small for you.
It's great for kids.
The right size for kids.
Yep.
It's also not completely waterproof. If you dunk it in water, it'll break it. But you can kind of like wash the surface.
Right.
Stuff, which is handy in places that are very dusty or very, very crummy that way. It has enough power to be a good ebook reader, to be a good platform for curriculum and stuff, and It's just really amazing. I mean, they came in at what, about $200 or $300, not $100. And
I think it was a couple of hundred. Yeah.
And you got yours through the give one get one program.
I did it right at the beginning. Now you can buy them, I think, but initially you had to buy two, and you would get one, and then one would be donated to a child in a developing nation. Maybe Nepal, they were all over the world. I was really glad to do this, and I was really fun to play with it. I mean, I think it's a very interesting device. In fact, you know, my son has said, I want to learn to hack, Dad. And I'm thinking, maybe I'll give him this, the turtle graphics, the squeak. You can go pretty far learning how to program with this thing.
And this is the basis for now many programs all around the world. Such as the one we're going to hear from Brian Berry in Nepal, but you know there's it in Uruguay and Brazil, all over the world. This is really raising the bar for the kinds of ways to do things. And it's funny. It's like it's actually saving money, because if you consider the cost of the paper for the books that they would have to buy instead, this actually comes out ahead in a given year.
It's brilliant. I really think it was a great idea. Of course, the guy who thought of this. Nick Negroponte. And Nick has taken a little heat for it, but I think it's a really great idea. And now, of course, what it's done is it's stimulated commercial entities to making little inexpensive laptops that they can sell in the emerging nations too. But I think the thought that went into the design of this UI and really makes this unique and wonderful. Now, how did you run into this guy? Because this is a pre-recorded interview.
Once again, I love it when the guests set themselves up. He wrote me and said, I really want to be on your show. And I said, okay. And then I kind of ignored him for a month because I was trying to figure out what the slots were coming up in April and May. And then he wrote me again. He said, come on, please, please. So this is great. And so we actually have a pre-recorded interview because I needed to get him when in his time zone. It's 11 hours, 45 minutes away. So I needed to call him very early in the morning to be able to reach him on time. So it's just a pre-recorded call for the live viewers today. You're not going to actually hear the call.
And you can go to olenepal.org if you want to read more. They've got a blog, a wiki. They've got a lot more information about all of this. Now, before we get to our guest, let me mention the Google Summer of Code. And anything else you want to talk about before we get to the guest?
Well, I don't know if you could see it on the webcam, you know, the live cam, as we were talking about for a second ago. I am wearing this shirt that has a circle of all of your shows. And guess what? Right over here, Floss Weekly. And I got this actually as a great gift. Lori LeBeau Walsh, who makes these shirts. She's at artandtechtees.com. She sent me, I am now entirely outfitted for a week because I have every single one of the Twit TV show of t-shirts. And I really appreciate that for her. So I told her I would be sure to wear the shirt at least once. So here I am wearing the shirt. Every time we tape, I'm going to be wearing one of her shirts. So this is really very cool.
Lori LeBeau Walsh from Art and Tech Tees. And you can also buy these online. You know, off the top of your head, I'm always forgetting the name of the site.
Artandtechtees.com, I think, would be a link
to it.
That's
one of them. And then there's another one. Is it t-shirts? Poor Lori. I know. To her every single freaking time.
She might even be in the chat room because I told her.
I have a brain like a sieve.
Oh, yes, me too. But yeah. I'm sure you could find it. If you just Google for like Twit TV t-shirts or something, I'm sure you'll get at least one or two sites that'll come close to it.
I'll get the name for you and I'll let you know.
Very good. Very good. Also, just to kind of wrap up some business from some of the previous shows, I had great response to having John O'Bacon on the show last
great.
Week, 2 weeks ago. And I tell you, since that show, he and I have chatted. He's even started doing live streaming. So he's now got his own TV show that he's doing because he saw so much fun of you doing it on this show and stuff. So now he's doing his own little weekly At Home with Jono, I think he's calling it. But he does, in fact, want to come back to Floss Weekly as often as we invite him to do a segment that we're calling Flossing with Bacon, just for fun. But he wants to, I think we're looking at a couple of different things. One is, like you suggested a couple weeks ago, I think having him guest host on the few weeks that I'm going to be tied up for whoever we're talking with that week. But also, I think at least bringing him back every 8 weeks or so to talk about the state of the world and the Linux world, which I don't know a lot about, but he is way tied into. So this would be a good overlap of his skills, my skills, and he wants to be back in the streaming world. And you know, this is a great way to get that. I mean, he misses Lug Radio, and he's now doing
he's welcome to come on anytime. I mean, he was funny and great.
One of the funnest shows that we have done ever. Yeah. I mean, absolutely. I mean, we've had some really incredible guests, and he's definitely one of those landmark shows that just I've just had a great time working with him, and he's very fun, and just we've been chatting back and forth, we've been twittering back and forth to each other, and just having a great time. So yeah,
we want to we'll talk in just a second about the Open Learning Exchange Nepal and the One Laptop program and so forth, but I do want to mention our friends at Google, the Google Summer of Code. Now the mentor organizations have already been picked. The students are in the application process, so it's too late to participate in the 2009 Summer of Code. Now it's time to start thinking about participating in 2010. If you want to be a mentor organization in the Google Summer of Code, you can do it. All you have to do is be any group running an active, free, open source software project. The project doesn't have to be legally incorporated, but you do have to produce and release software under an open source initiative approved license. You can go to code.google.com/SOC to see previous year's mentors organizations. Why would you want to do this? It's a great way to support kids studying computer science in college right now. Give them a way to introduce them to open source programming, to being part of a project. It's great for them. They get paid to code by Google. You get great code and introduced to great new coders. It's kind of really the best of both worlds. It's been around since 2005. Nearly 2,500 students have been brought together by the Google Summer of Code to write millions of lines of code. It's just a really, really wonderful organization. Google's done such a great job with this. And so many projects that we know of have received help from the Summer of Code. And many coders who've gone from the Summer of Code have gone on to become very important parts of the open source community. There will be 150 mentor organizations selected. You could be one of them. Here's what you do. You go to socghop.appspot.com. socghop.appspot.com. You could see this year's mentor organizations. Their applications, you can review the projects and find out more. And again, if you want to see previous years, code.google.com/SOC, the Summer of Code. I'm just really thrilled that Google is doing it. I really appreciate their support of Floss Weekly advertising on our show. I don't know, Randall, but I can't think of any other time that Google has bought advertising. It's not something they normally do.
I think we pulled a coup on this one.
Yeah, definitely. Well, it's just great, and we really appreciate their support, and for the open source community in general, and for Floss Weekly specifically. Thank you, Google. The Summer of Code. Now, let's get to that phone conversation you had.
Mm-hmm.
Who are you talking to?
It'll be Brian Berry of OLE Nepal. So let's roll the tape. So I'm speaking now with Mr. Brian Berry. He's the CTO of the Open Learning Exchange Nepal. Welcome, Brian.
Oh, great to be here. Thanks, Randall.
Yes. Now, where are you right now? I think you're in Nepal, right?
That's right. I'm in Kathmandu, Nepal, the lovely capital of a very small but wonderful country.
And I haven't been in Nepal, and I bet a lot of our audience hasn't been. What's the country like? Can you describe it in a few sentences?
It's very varied. On one side of the country, about a third of it is the Himalayas. So very high, very ruggedest mountain terrain in the world. Mm-hmm. The middle part of it is they call the Middle Hills, which is also very rugged. And then the bottom third is all basically equatorial plains where it's incredibly hot and humid.
So quite a variety then of terrains and things. I mean, let's see. So the north end is the Himalayas. Isn't that where the tallest mountain in the world is? Isn't that close?
That's right. Mount Everest. That's right. You got it.
I'm a stupid American.
Also,
I don't know where things are.
And also, it's a very interesting country. It's about 26 million people in a country the size of Tennessee.
Ooh, very dense. And is it consistently dense everywhere, or is there a lot of rural areas?
It's not consistently dense because the Himalayan areas logically, because you can't grow food there, and it's much more rugged terrain, much lower populations.
Uh-huh. Okay. But Kathmandu is the capital, so it's probably pretty dense there.
It's very densely populated because it's a small area with a lot of people. It's only about 2 or 3 million people, but they're all crammed down on top of each other.
Mm-hmm. And is that where you spend most of your time, or do you have to go out further out when you're doing your project?
I spend most of my time in Kathmandu, but the people on my team go out all around Nepal to very remote and rural places, because that's what this project's about. It's taking education to kids where they are, not just in the cities.
So tell me more about that, since I brought that up.
Oh, sure. Well, I mean, there's the general OLPC project, which there's many aspects to, mm-hmm. but there's the kind of a central problem that here in Nepal we're interested in. And that is, we have a lot of kids, about 6 million kids, that need to get education. And how can we get these kids in Nepal into the modern world? Mm-hmm. It's not like, Nepal may be a poor country, but it's not like you can just live in a poor country and be uneducated. If you're illiterate in Nepal, if you're not educated, that means the difference between hauling rocks on your back or having a job with real opportunities.
Wow.
Makes all the difference. I mean, if you're illiterate, you are hauling rocks and climbing up mountains for the rest of your life. It's not, it makes all the difference.
Are there many white-collar jobs there, or is it still mostly blue-collar laborers and a very small elite of white-collar?
No, there are a number of white-collar jobs, but a lot of jobs that we think of as blue-collar require literacy.
Of course.
They require basic mathematical skills.
So prior to the project that you're involved in of helping to bring OLPC XOs to the area, what's sort of the state of the world there? I mean, is there much in the way of literacy education, like with or without computers, or is it still pretty rare?
Oh, it's the literacy rate here, I believe, I believe it's about 45%.
Okay.
But among young people, it's around 80%.
Mm.
Still, though, there may be literacy, but education is very different from what you and I would understand based in the West.
And how is that different?
In Nepal, when you go, even in Kathmandu, but for all Nepal, there aren't any libraries. There are only a couple libraries in Kathmandu itself. Most people's parents are illiterate or very barely educated. So there aren't any books at home. At school, how it works is that the teacher speaks and the kids repeat. You got about one teacher for about 50 kids. They don't have time to do homework. So basically the teacher speaks and the kids repeat. It's completely rote learning.
Mm.
And I don't blame the teachers. They're doing their best, but they have almost no resources. There's one time I went into a school and I asked a kid a math problem. So I said, what's 2 plus 1? He said, 3. Then I asked him, okay, what's 1 plus 2? And he didn't know.
Oh.
And that's very indicative of what education is like here in Nepal, but also most of the developing world.
Mm-hmm.
That's because you only have so many teachers and you have a lot of kids.
Right. So instead
of
learning,
aren't many resources.
They're just learning to be parrots then, in other words. They're not really learning to have thinking going on.
Exactly. And what the really exciting thing about the OLPC project is that you can really put a lot more resources in the hands of kids and teachers. Because that's all the computer gives you. It doesn't transform kids into being, computer scientists. It doesn't make teachers 10 times better. But
now,
situations like
the heart of the OLPC project, you're talking about the OLPC XO itself, but it's really sort of a whole infrastructure, right?
It is a whole infrastructure. But when you put computers in schools in general, and not just the OLPC laptop, you're adding a lot more resources. In an area like Nepal or Africa or the rest of South Asia, much of the underdeveloped world, that's really transformative.
Now, some of the people at home probably aren't familiar with the XO. I know a lot of people are, but can you describe what the XO is? Or that's what you're using, right? The XO model?
Well, I really think the XO is a groundbreaking piece of hardware. It's a small, durable, low-power laptop. Most of the laptops you get or you can buy, I mean, almost all of them, are not designed to be taken apart. They're not designed to be thrown against the wall.
Mm-hmm.
They aren't designed to deal with less than first world conditions.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas the XO laptop has no moving parts. It's completely solid state. It's very durable. You can take it apart and fix it like you could your motorcycle. It's the first laptop that I've worked with that is really designed for a rugged environment. And it's low power, very low power. I think it's 3 to 5 watts.
Now, at one point, they were looking at hand cranks for these things. Are you using that or using just community power to charge these up?
Right now, we're just using grid power. The hand crank is a wonderful meme that just doesn't seem to go away. I mean, you're going to break the table before you generate enough energy to keep that laptop running all day.
Now, the one thing that I think is fascinating about the OLPC is that the XO is that it's all open source software. And this is sort of what brought you to actually be talking to me, is that this is a project where open source is critical to the success of the project. Can you talk about that?
Certainly. Open source is absolutely critical to high quality education. That is that education is something that has to be very customized for the kids, for the teacher, for the environment, for the country. Mm-hmm. It's not something you can design in New York City or design in some one city and somehow it will fit another in a completely different circumstance. Also, we in the open source community know that through this iterative process of other people looking at your code, looking at your work, they can make it better. That's absolutely true of education as well.
So what kind of customization had to happen for the software for your particular project?
Oh, that's a lot. can we break that question up into parts?
Sure, exactly. However you want to talk about that, it's fine.
Sure. One of the big problems is we had to get to render Nepali, which is Devanagari script, properly.
Okay. Is that right to left, or is that just, it's complex?
It's left to right, but there's very limited support. Even though it's Unicode, there's very limited support across different applications and rendering environments. We also had to make it conform to the Nepali National Student Curriculum.
Mm.
That is, conform to what kids have to learn throughout the year. Mm-hmm. This is absolutely critical. The teachers I've met, almost 99% of them really care about their kids. They mm-hmm. want their kids to learn. And they don't want their kids to fail the exams at the end of the year.
Mm-hmm.
If their kids fail those exams, they're set back a year. So you can say to them, hey, we've got this great learning software. Their kids will learn better. And they'll say, fantastic, but I have to make sure my kids don't fail that exam.
Mm.
This is typical of America, pretty much every country.
Yeah, teaching to the test, yes.
You have to do that because if you don't have standards, you don't have a system.
Mm-hmm.
So what we did was we tried to get away from the rote learning to something more dynamic. But we created a whole set of learning activities that conform to the national curriculum so the teachers don't have to worry that they're shortchanging their kids.
Okay.
And we first started off doing it in eToys with Squeak.
Yes.
Do you know Luke Gore, Bert Freudenberg?
I know Bert, yeah. I'm on the Squeak Board of Advisors for now the second year in a row, so I've been playing with Squeak for a long time. So yes, I'm familiar with that side of the project.
Great.
We love eToys, mm-hmm. and we worked for the first 6 months. We did all our development in basically using Squeak mm-hmm. to create graphical learning activities for the kids.
Mm-hmm.
And it was great. The only problem was performance. Three problems, actually. Performance. There's a very, very small community in the Squeak doing what we were doing.
Mm-hmm.
And the third problem is that Squeak programmers tend to be very smart and tend to go to PhD programs and leave us behind.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, our best programmers left for graduate school. Oh. And so it was a very tough situation.
Mm-hmm. So what did you do next?
We went to Flash.
Okay.
Flash is a great technology. Unfortunately, the runtime is proprietary, which is a problem.
Did you consider using, is it Ganache or whatever, the open source version?
We did consider it, and I think that Rob Savoy and team at Ganache are doing great work.
Mm-hmm.
But we're having some stability and performance issues as well.
Mm.
So basically, we release our code as under the MIT license.
Mm-hmm.
Everything we do, but we're using the proprietary Flash runtime. I feel that the next step the really key part to creating great learning activities. Mm-hmm. The next step after Flash really is JavaScript and HTML5.
Cool.
That's really the way to go, because there's a lot of community people who know those tools. There's mm-hmm. a lot of momentum in that area. Also, the thing is, unfortunately, proprietary code and doing your stuff in a closed source way is really baked into education. But if by getting people to do things with JavaScript, HTML, there's a you almost can't keep your stuff proprietary.
Right.
So it creates a very virtuous feedback loop, like you see in the Ajax community, where you have all these content companies that really aren't necessarily interested in releasing their code as open source, but yet it helps the whole industry develop.
So how is this organized? So you keep saying we created this stuff in Flash and OLPC. You're the CTO, so you're like a technology director, but you're obviously working with other people then who are writing the code in your organization, and how are they interfacing with the school administrations and the government to make this deploy?
Sure. It's a Nepali-led organization led by Ravi Karmacharya.
Okay.
We have about 30 people full-time now. Mm-hmm. It's a nonprofit. We have a team of developers we have some people part-time. Oh, we have a number of open-source contributors, and we have about... I'd say we have about 10 people working full time. The key part where you're doing educational software is you really have to have teachers and you got to have teachers working together with developers.
Right.
Because the teachers are so creative and they really know, they really have a good sense of what needs to be done. Not just, of course, the lesson plan, but really they're incredibly creative and so wonderful at creating games that engage the children.
Especially if they've had a lot of field time, because I know that one of the things I was doing, I've done a lot of corporate training, and the way I trained in the beginning versus the way I train now was completely shaped by watching for things like eyes glazed over and stuff in the actual classrooms. Yeah. So you're working with seasoned teachers to be able to create the stuff that you need then, right?
Absolutely.
Now, how has that process been going? Was this seen by anybody as a threat initially? Like, no, we want to do it our way? Or were you always welcomed with open arms? Or was it somewhere in the middle?
I think as far as a threat, well, the teachers, once we showed them the learning activities, mm-hmm. they welcomed it with open arms. Mm. They saw it as a way to do what they were trying to do already, but making their lives easier. They didn't see as giving them an extra burden.
Mm.
The Nepali government was very very supportive because, again, they have struggling with all these issues of 6 million kids and trying to get them high-quality education. They saw it as a great opportunity.
So how does this change the way they deal with the kids day by day instead of just giving the phrase 2+1 and make them repeat it? What's the classroom like now that the OLPCs are being deployed?
What's really great is that before... there was a good reason the teacher spoke and the kids repeat. They had 50 kids mm-hmm. and no resources, no lab, no. All they had is a chalkboard and 50 kids. Now what they can do is they can introduce a concept,
mm-hmm.
have the kids then work the lesson on the XO, and the teacher walks around, asks the kids questions, helps the kids that are having problems, and the kids that are excelling can help the kid next to them that isn't finding it so easy. It frees up the teacher to do a lot of stuff that you and I may have taken for granted growing up in the U.S., where your teacher had time to come talk to you and see what you were having trouble with, mm-hmm. to grade your homework, to give you tips.
Wow. And so you're also seeing, I like what you said, though, that their kids are helping each other with this, that there's enough resource there in the machines and in the way the programs are set up that people can help each other.
Oh, absolutely. Definitely. And the great thing is we're using the Sugar user interface. Mm-hmm. Are you familiar with that?
Just barely.
Okay. So, it's a really great, basically a window manager and learning environment designed specifically for kids. What's fantastic about it, it has collaboration baked in to it.
Mm-hmm.
So that it really makes everything that you're doing easy to share, easy to all the activities, it's always possible to collaborate with someone else. So you can have chat running in the background. When you go to, we have like I have Network Manager on my Ubuntu box, but they have a network neighborhood where not only do you see the hotspots, but you see icons of your friends, and you can invite them to work on an essay with you, to listen to a music file, to browse the web with you.
This seems like such a strong contrast to the way we want to use laptops or so in the U.S., where we say chat is forbidden.
Yeah, exactly. Don't use YouTube. Don't use Wikipedia.
And
don't you dare collaborate.
Now, what's the timing been like? Have you did a small pilot program already and seen that through to its end, or where are you on the initial small group of deployments? I know you're having a major deployment now, but where what's the history been so far?
So I got started on this 3 years ago when I first came to Nepal. A year ago, that'd be April 2007. Sorry, 2008. My dates are out of whack. We deployed 150 laptops to two poor schools in just outside Kathmandu. These were to class two. So I got that second grade. These are 7 year olds.
Okay.
And to sixth graders. With 150 kids, and the results were amazing. We were so worried because we'd been working on this project for so long, we didn't actually know what would happen. And what happened was, the kids were and the teachers were so into it. We were especially afraid that the second graders wouldn't take care of their laptops. And they treated them like gold.
Wow.
You know, just, you know, 7 year olds, these are tiny little kids. They, you know, besides their clothes, you know, and maybe a ball at home, they don't have any possessions of their own.
Now, was this a one-on-one? I mean, was there one machine to a kid?
Oh, that's absolutely critical. It has to be one per kid.
Okay. And did they stay in the class? Did they stay in the classroom, or did they get to take them home?
No, take them home.
Wow, that's a degree of trust, I think.
The thing is, the kids value what's their own, and they know the laptop's important, and they enjoy using a laptop. There's a difference, though, in Nepal and say other countries. When you ask kids what they want to be when they grow up, they don't say pop star or baseball player. Most times they'll say, I want to be an engineer or a doctor, or a businessman.
Okay.
They don't say that math sucks or math is boring. Actually, they think math's great.
Wow.
There's a real embrace and excitement about learning. And on the other hand, an incredible shortage of resources.
Wow. Now, the way these OLPCs work, they don't need like a central access point to have that cooperative chat mode. So like if two kids wanted to work together at home, they could, right?
That's correct.
Wow. And somehow these things just wake up and find each other, and you've got all the same facilities you have when you're in the classroom then.
For the most part, yes.
Are there access points then that would allow them to get on the internet in the classroom?
Yes, we set up access points at the schools so they can connect to the internet.
Now, what about the, you know, obviously the next question is going to be, what about the concern of them getting onto the internet and finding things they shouldn't be finding? Was that ever, was that a concern? Did it occur? Did it come up?
It is. It hasn't occurred so far, but we have a Dan's Guardian for content filtering.
Okay.
My biggest concern is not that the kids, you know, I don't want the kids to access stuff that they shouldn't. These are kids. It's up to their parents to decide this. My biggest concern is that adults will use up all the bandwidth looking at adult sites. That's absolutely my biggest concern, is that they'll chew up all the bandwidth.
What kind of bandwidth are you able to get to the classroom?
You'd be about 64K.
Oh, for all 30 or 40 XOs that are all trying to surf the web, huh?
Oh, no, about 80 kids, yeah.
Wow. So they're obviously not going to be watching, everybody's going to be watching a separate YouTube video. Of course, these things don't work that fast. They probably wouldn't be watching.
Oh, they work fine. You can do that.
Wow. Yeah.
And we do, I believe very firmly that it's in community standards for content. And so we do content filtering.
Okay.
One of the key things is we set up content filtering in our own office, mirroring what we have at the school. To make sure that, so I can, you know, if I can access something I shouldn't at my office, then I know there's a problem at the school.
Right. Do these XOs have the ability to do delayed chats, like email, or what we would call email?
Only with Gmail.
Okay.
Currently. You know, the thing is, it's just setting up this project, there's just been a lot of work.
Mm-hmm.
And we haven't done been able to do nearly as much on the server side as we'd like to.
Okay.
Also, as you probably know, setting up email on a server is it's a big hassle.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you can do it, but you have to do a lot of stuff to, you know, screen. You know, there's a lot of maintenance involved.
Mm-hmm.
As far as spam filtering, making sure you don't run out of disk space, resetting passwords, etc. Which is fine if you have an administrator hanging around, but, mm-hmm. but not if you don't. The idea is that these pilots only need, you know, very minimal maintenance and support. Mm-hmm. What we found, Randall, is that in these communities, we can always find someone who can fix the laptop itself, the hardware.
Wow. Okay.
But training someone to master the Linux command line is a long-term proposition.
Mm-hmm. Took me most of my life, so yeah.
yeah. So, you know, the server has to be as simple as possible. If there's a problem with the XO, there's a fantastic firmware-level tool called TestAll, and they can mm-hmm. test all the hardware. Mm-hmm. If something fails, they replace that hardware component.
Now, this pilot project that you started last year, has it gone to completion now? And do you have objective numbers that show that this is actually working for the students?
It's ongoing. We have objective numbers. We have surveys. Mm-hmm. Objective numbers will take a long time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, to see if they do better. You know, again, if they do better on the test, well, that depends if we geared everything we did to the test.
Mm-hmm.
He's a Walter Bender, one of the founders of OLPC and now one of the leaders of Sugar Labs. He said the hard part with assessing education is you have to wait 20 years.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, sure, right.
That's the real hard part. Did these kids go on to be successes? Not did they score XYZ, X percent better on some random arbitrary test. But assessment is very important, because if we don't assess, how can we justify expense? How can we justify all the trouble going into this? And not into something else.
Are the teachers finding in general though, that the kids are more cooperative and excited about being in school because of this?
Yeah, definitely. Sometimes too much.
What, they keep staying after school or something?
Well, the thing is, one of the problems is we have to stagger putting out learning activities.
Okay.
According to the curriculum.
Yeah.
Because the kids will do all of them as soon as they get the software. And these are not like sexy games. These are games like, one game we have, it takes your picture.
Yeah.
Then it shows you a photo frame, and you have to do multiplication problems in order for the picture to fill in.
Oh, wow.
Block by block.
Uh-huh.
And these are like 85 divided by 5 or uh-huh. 2000 times, or 222 times 15.
Mm-hmm.
This is not like race car games.
Right.
The kids, run all right through it.
I think that would be an indication that you're on the right track, because I remember not having that much enthusiasm for doing math problems when I was growing up.
Really? Oh, right.
Wow. That is really amazing. Now, has the successes that you've been able to show so far, has that made it easier to get the more government cooperation, or were they just online right to begin with you?
They were supportive.
Okay.
The key thing is to build government capacity. It's not like they have a bunch of people that are very open source savvy hanging mm-hmm. around.
Mm-hmm.
So building capacity is important. And expanding it this year was also important, because we're expanding from 150 laptops last year to 2,500 laptops this year.
Wow.
All across.
Wow. And is this pretty comprehensive then, or are you hitting like every school in an area or something?
Oh, no, we're trying to hit geographically dispersed places that really represent the breadth of life in Nepal.
Oh, wow, even better for more accurate results. And cool.
Yeah. And man, is it stressing me out.
Yeah, I was going to say, what's the biggest challenges in that? I'm guessing getting the internet to each of those sites. And
The internet's hard, but it just, from an organizational point, growing our organization to support the deployment is a huge challenge.
Well, I guess you're probably also having to deal with separate representatives then from each of those schools, and they're all in separate hierarchies and stuff, right?
That's hard, but that's not the hardest part. It just is growing your organization,
mm-hmm.
Growing our support organization. To running a volunteer organization, grassroots, mm-hmm. I have found is very different from running an open source community. online.
Mm-hmm. And how is it different?
Online, there's an automatic barrier to entry that filters out people that aren't really interested.
Mm-hmm.
Because they don't get anything by showing up.
Right.
They don't get anything by hanging on RSC. There's no, the only advantage is they're learning about something that's interesting in them.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas running a volunteer organization where we have some full-time staff and some and a lot of part-time, or what, not part-time, but a lot of, you know, a huge number of people are volunteers,
mm-hmm.
is that you have to make sure that you get the people that are really serious.
Right.
And that are going to be there 4 months from now when you're going into the rural parts of Nepal.
Because you put investment into these people's time to train them to do what you need them to do, and it's really be sad to just have them walk away a month later.
Absolutely. I've talked to people who run grassroots volunteer organizations. They always say the same thing, in that a lot of people want to come and talk to you. They want to visit the school. They want to be part of it, but they're not going to hang around for 3 months and do the grunt work.
Mm-hmm.
So that part of running a volunteer organization is just that was one of the hardest things to figure out and to work and manage.
Is there any like red tape that has to be dealt with to make this all work? I mean, I'm sure there's like paperwork that needs to be filled out and stuff, but is the government trying to streamline this to really make it happen?
Not so much paperwork. There's a lot of stuff that has to be dealt with, you know, making sure that the materials we develop are accepted as part of the curriculum.
Mm-hmm.
So that the teachers know that that has the government's stamp of approval when we show the activities to the teachers. Like, look, this actually is in line with the curriculum. Your kids aren't going to fail at the end of the year.
Right.
This will help them do what you're supposed to teach them anyways.
Actually, that gets another issue. How about parents? Have the parents been welcoming this?
They've been welcoming it. The funny thing is that parents just want books. we show them, they want to see like books, digital books.
Right.
We show them the math activities, you know, like show the picture filling in when you do 85 divided by 3 or mm-hmm. 11 times 22. They're like, yeah, whatever. Give my kid a book.
Do you think it's because of the generation gap that they didn't grow up around computers or video games and therefore they're used to books and so they want to see books because of that?
Definitely. Yeah. I think they see books. Learning happens with a book.
Mm-hmm.
And that's actually what we call the XO laptop. What they call it in the schools, they call it e-pati, which means e-blackboard.
Okay.
The idea is taking something that they're used to and appropriating it to the laptop.
Where do you find your volunteers? Is there local recruitment that happens? Are you looking internationally? How do people get involved with this project at the volunteer level?
We have a lot of local volunteers.
Uh-huh. Are they coming from the schools?
Most of them are 18 and above because they can get around and they have free time.
Right.
But they're interested in open source software and this project. We have a number of foreign volunteers mm-hmm. as well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, from Holland, there's the wonderful T. Stau. We had Luke Gorey who came here earlier. Mm-hmm. A lot of great volunteers. The key thing is that we get volunteers to come that can train Nepalese. To have mm-hmm. an area of specialization that they can come and really transfer their knowledge.
Okay.
To Nepalis.
And is there, you know, outside of the OLE project, is the open source community strong there in Nepal?
It's, you know, it's a dichotomy there and a paradox. There is an incredible amount of enthusiasm about open source.
Mm-hmm.
The Software Freedom Day, Nepal's celebration of Software Freedom Day, I believe won 2 years in a row for Best Software Freedom Day.
Mm, okay.
From the FSF.
Right.
At the same time, there's not much open source software being developed. Very little, in fact.
Mm.
That comes down to the fact of free time.
Mm-hmm.
Kids here have to study hard so they can get a job and support their parents.
And so there's just nothing to know. We don't have like the abundance of recreational time that we would have here, say, in the States.
Exactly. One, they have to study hard. Two, they have more family commitments than we do in the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
If your grandma gets sick, you got to go to the hospital and stay with her till she gets better.
Wow.
Because that's how hospitals are. They don't have an orderly that comes and checks on your grandma.
Now, you're working for an NGO. How is this funded? Is this government funded, donation funded?
Donations, government, foreign donors, a number of sources.
And
we received the bulk of our funding from the Danish development. I'm sorry, no, the Embassy of Denmark here in Kathmandu.
That's unusual. How did that happen?
They fund a lot of innovative education projects
here around the world too, not just Nepal.
Nepal and a number of other less developed countries.
Oh wow, that's really impressive. What can you just for ballpark? What, can you say kind of what the general like budget is?
I'd rather not. It's not very much.
Okay, that's fine. Then. It's not very much.
It's not very much. by very little by Western standards.
Very good. Now, so did you have to then buy the 2,500 OLPCs out of that budget?
No, that was donated by the SWIFT organization.
What's
which is
that?
It's a banking cooperative okay. Made up of most of a lot of large European banks.
Oh, very cool.
But even then, I always believe that buying laptops will be the least of our concerns.
Is that like the smallest part of your cost then too? Or
no, it's the largest part, but it's always going to be the easiest part to fund.
Okay.
There are always people that want to buy laptops, and there are a lot of Nepali communities that want to pay for them, even if it's on a microfinance basis.
Mm-hmm.
The hard part is to get the organization together that can support it. And just as important is building the educational content that is tied into the national curriculum.
Okay. That's good to know. But it sounds like, yeah, that the infrastructure is always the tough part because it's the follow-up. It's the what needs to come next that's interesting
yeah.
and difficult and complex actually because it involves a lot of people. Do these kids get to keep the laptops at the end of the year or
yep.
Yes, they do?
Yes. Yeah.
Wow. So they're going to get to carry them forward through third and fourth grade then with different curriculums being added every year?
As long as we can keep developing it.
Wow. So that really is there. So now, I don't know, do they have the equivalent of a summer break like we have in the States?
Yes. But it happens in March.
Okay. And so that's happening what now or well, no, right. Sorry, this is April now, but did the kids bring them back to third grade? Did it work? Wow. Very
yeah.
cool.
I'm not worried about when the laptop breaks, no, 9 times out of 10, it's because it was faulty to begin with.
Wow. Okay.
There is the one kid that washed his laptop because it was dirty and he wanted it to be nice and clean.
You know, I can't imagine the electronics inside were too happy about the water.
Yeah.
Not very cool. Although they're not waterproof, but they're somewhat water resistant, right?
They're pretty water resistant, yeah.
Wow, that's very cool. I've got to touch a couple of them. The first time a couple years ago down in Brazil when we were at the Fizzly, that was really impressive. And I've seen them, a few people around here have the Give One, Get One program and had them locally. So they're cute looking. I can't say anything other than they're cute looking because I haven't actually got to play with it. So at least I got to touch it.
For adults, they're pretty frustrating.
And why is that?
They're so small. The keyboard, you can't get your fingers on it.
Are they in a QWERTY layout? I guess, no, wait a second. For Nepali, it would have to be switched around, right?
It's QWERTY with a Nepali overlay.
Mm-hmm.
So it has both English and Nepali on it.
Was the interacting with the keyboard any part of the issue, or did the kids kind of just immediately just want to start learning how to hit the keys and do what they wanted to do?
They wanted, the kids are able to figure it out in the keyboard, but one of the earliest requests was for a typing tutor so they could learn how to type faster.
Yes. I imagine if you're interacting by typing, you want to make that as quick as you can.
Yeah. And the adults also wanted a typing tutor. And now there is a great program actually developed by Wade Brainerd, a fantastic guy called Typing Turtle, which is a great typing game.
Mm-hmm. Are the EXOs environmentally resistant enough for what I consider probably unusual environment requirements for Nepal?
Now they are. We had a lot of trouble with the touchpad last year because it wasn't it didn't do very well in a dry, in a wet and dusty environment.
Mm-hmm. That sounds like mud to me. Wet and dust sound like mud to me together. But
yeah.
Yeah. Okay. But this year,
the touchpad's a lot better.
Okay.
They really did a great job.
Being able to work with the manufacturers to figure out what really needs to get done.
Yeah. So the touchpad's much better. The interesting thing, have you spent much time with eToys, Randall?
A little bit.
Yeah, it's a fantastic environment, and especially for, you know, teaching kids how to build things.
Mm-hmm.
But the biggest problem, we wanted to teach the teachers how to use eToys to teach lessons to the kids.
Mm-hmm.
But the biggest problem we had was that programs like eToys and other graphical kind of editing environments where you drag and drop stuff,
yes,
require a lot of dexterity with a touchpad that a lot of us take for granted.
Oh, yeah, I can imagine. Yes, because I have a touchpad on my laptop, and I'm always like trying to figure out how to do the right kind of stuff with that. And it's stuff you take for granted on that. Yeah.
Just the drag and drop stuff. The teachers and the kids, you know, were able to figure out the keyboard very easily, mm-hmm. and use the mouse for pointing and clicking. Mm-hmm. But a lot of the teachers really struggled with the dragging and dropping.
Are the kids now? eToys sort of allows you to write sort of little programs without really knowing programming. Now that you've sort of gotten away from eToys, have you replaced that kind of environment with there's like a turtle logo or something on there?
There's turtle art.
Okay.
Yeah, and they can still use those programs, and we encourage them to. Mm-hmm. We look forward to seeing kids play a lot with those programs.
Mm-hmm.
A key thing that we really need to do is tie lesson plans into working with those programs.
Okay.
Because teachers are busy, like in the U.S. If something's an add-on or an extra, too often there won't be time for it. It has to be integrated in the curriculum.
Wow. This has just been remarkable. You've really painted a pretty broad picture of what is going on. I mean, a lot more than I was aware of. This is really incredible. What brought you to this program? How did you end up in Nepal, and how did you find out about this project, and what motivated you to join?
Oh, okay. I've been living and working abroad for the last, I guess, about 7 years. I was working for the State Department. I was a member of the Foreign Service, managing the IT at the embassies, mm-hmm. first in Tel Aviv, then Hong Kong, mm-hmm. then lastly, Kathmandu.
Okay.
I've traveled a lot, and everywhere I've been, I've seen that education is the absolute essential that you have to move out of poverty for any country.
Okay.
You can have all the bridges you want and all the infrastructure, but if there isn't human capital, your country and people aren't going to move forward.
Mm.
There's also, this takes the longest to build up.
Wow. So how did that make you see what you needed to do here?
It just seems so obvious, mm-hmm. that the laptop was this lever that it could help countries like Nepal jump forward.
Was the project already in place before you got started?
Nope. When I first got here, there were some people interested in it, but I got them more organized, and we started promoting the project and moving it forward.
And how did you do that? Was there local, not user groups or something? Was it education groups that you were approaching?
No, I started together with some follies. We started just basically an interest group. We started holding meetings,
mm-hmm.
and producing promotional materials, creating learning activities, and doing everything we could to promote the project.
And you got together with your director and things like that to create the organization then and do all the appropriate paperwork to make it an NGO?
Yes.
And at what point did you approach the central OLPC organization to talk about what the requirements were and like costs and timelines?
From the first day that I was interested, I started spamming them with email.
Wow. Okay. So you're really the instigator then?
One of the instigators. Okay. I got to give a full credit to Ravi Karmacharya, who is the executive director of OLE Nepal.
Okay.
He is, you know, a tremendous guy. He attended MIT, worked in Silicon Valley, and then chose to come back to Nepal because he really cared about his country.
Mm-hmm.
He ran a successful software company, and he gave that all up to run our little NGO.
What was the biggest hurdle early in that cycle, and what did you do to overcome it?
The biggest hurdle. There were many.
Well, any three then. I'm saying this for the people listening at home that want to do this in their country. I'm trying to figure out.
I would say the biggest hurdle, it really goes back to something I heard from Mark Shuttleworth.
Okay.
And also I think I heard it on your program.
Okay.
From on the Django, you had a talk with Adrian Holovati, is that you have to create a firewall between a company and the open source community.
Mm-hmm.
Because what happened early on is we started an open source community, and some people in the group saw it as their own personal project. And early on, we established a hierarchy, mm-hmm. Where some people saw it as their project. And that was very detrimental.
Because it really has to be the whole community owning the results of this to really make it work well.
It does. It has to be, when you're an open source community, you have to be not tied to any particular implementer.
Mm-hmm.
Because very soon, once money gets involved, and so, as soon as the government really jumped on this project, some people in our group saw this as an opportunity for them. And it was incredibly destructive to the community.
Mm-hmm. And so how did you manage that? What did you do?
It was ugly.
Okay.
The same thing happened in Nigeria, Argentina, where you have to make it very, very distinct that the community is not involved in getting a government, a contract. The community is just something that's supporting and advocating the project.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why we formed OLE Nepal as a separate organization. So there's still, a greater OLPC community in Nepal. The idea was that OLE, just like, say, Canonical, is something separate.
Okay. Now, you mentioned Nigeria and the other place. Are you coordinating a lot with your peers in other projects in other countries then?
Well, I work pretty closely with the guys in Uruguay, in Oceania,
mm-hmm.
Austria, and several other countries.
Mm-hmm.
Work pretty closely.
And so that was one of the challenges. What's some of the other things that people might be able to make use of your experience from?
Create content first.
Okay.
Local content. Before you put together the flyers, before you have a meeting with government, you can show them a laptop. That's just a laptop.
Right.
They want to see stuff in their own language that has to do with their education system.
Right. Make it more
real. That makes
it
real.
Yeah.
Yeah. In a lot of countries, people just don't see it as, something like computers that you do Windows and, Office with.
Mm-hmm.
They don't see what the connection to education is.
Right. Speaking of that, I know that Microsoft has made some hand wavings of having a similar low-cost laptop, but it would be running Windows. What do you have to say about that?
I know there are a number of netbooks and other low-cost computers that do run Windows. The more low-cost, cheap computers out there, the happier I am.
Okay.
And it's up to deployment teams to choose to use Linux.
Mm-hmm.
And we use Linux because, of course, I have my own personal point of view. Open source is the way to go.
Mm-hmm.
But also because it supports Nepali.
Ah,
much
right.
Better. That's out of the box. And Nepal has 60 different, indigenous languages. And I'm not going to go to Microsoft and ask them to do translations.
Okay.
From a purely nationalist point of view, as a Nepali, which I'm not, but my partner, the education executive director, for him, Linux is the way to go because he knows that Microsoft's not going to do Tamang translations.
Wow.
Or, 10 different translations for the different languages in Nepal.
Does open source have much penetration in the government there?
No, not very much.
So it's all Windows and everything for the parts that are computerized? Okay.
Yeah.
Wow. Does that make it hard then when you're talking to government level organizations that you want to bring in something that's not Windows?
They don't. It's different than their desktop computer, so they don't really think about it that way.
Ah, okay. So you're sneaking in under the radar that way.
To some extent, yeah. It also helps that we're in Nepal, a small country. So there's less pressure from other corporate entities than if we were in a larger country.
Sure. The 2500 OLPCXOs that you're rolling out, is it this month? What you're going to a lot of different areas, but now if you had your druthers and somebody came along with a $1 billion check or whatever and could build out the infrastructure quick enough, what do you think the penetration would have to be? How many OLPCs would you need to give one to every student?
I wouldn't even focus on laptops. I'd focus on building out the content.
Okay.
I think that once there is a fully open source, high quality educational content from grades 1 through 12,
yes,
everyone's going to buy laptops.
Okay.
And it'll be a no-brainer for funding it for the long term.
I'm just wondering, is it 2,500 out of 25 million? I'm just trying to get a sense of...
That's 6 million.
6 million. So that's the... So this is a good sampling, but really you're just the tip of the iceberg in terms of getting infrastructure, getting curriculum and everything else.
Yeah.
Wow. Cool. Well, I really I really wish you success on the next phase of your project. This has really been fascinating chatting with you. Oh, just one more thing before we get away from that. You also run the website, oilpcnews.com. You want to talk about that?
Yes, I'm co-editor of that. It's just it's a great news source for everything related to OLPC. It's updated a lot. We have a lot of great information if you're interested in learning more about OLPC from a number of different vantage points. Mm-hmm. That's a good place to go.
And your blog on blog.oilenepal.org.
Yes.
You update that frequently?
Quite frequently. Well, okay. Mostly with updates from the schools and working with the teachers and the kids.
Very good. And for our audience, how can we help? What can we do if we were moved by what you have been saying? Where would we go? Would give one, get one be useful? Would sending donations directly to you be useful? Tell me the options of how to help.
Oh, donations would be great. The biggest donation is if someone out there would take my job. Because I'm going to leave Nepal this fall, sometime later this fall, with my lovely fiance. So I'm going to be moving on. Our great executive director, Robbie Karmacharya, is still going to be in the helm. Mm-hmm. But we're really looking for a new CTO to take my job.
Okay.
As someone who's passionate about software, passionate about education. Mm-hmm. They can be Nepali, Indian, from wherever. Mm-hmm. But someone who's just a great project manager to help us keep going forward.
That is incredible. It sounds like a dream job for someone out there. Not me, because I don't speak Nepali. So
You don't have to.
Really?
No, I don't.
Really? You don't speak the local language?
I spent most of my time learning Linux. So the big language kind of barrier for me over the last few years is learning as much as I can about Linux.
Uh-huh. Do the technology people there speak English mostly?
Staff speak English well or better than I do.
Okay.
We have an abundance of what we call Boston Brahmins that are Nepalese who went to MIT or Harvard now work for.
Oh, no. That's great. That's great. And how else can we help besides taking your job away from you?
We could always use donations to create more content.
Okay.
Because creating content is an expensive process.
Mm-hmm.
You got to have full-time graphic designers and teachers on staff.
Mm-hmm.
We have open source developers helping us, but it's really critical to have those teachers coming up with the lesson plans, structuring the activities, and so forth.
They probably have to be locals for that, right? Because you really need to know the local curriculum and how
absolutely.
To fit in with it, right? Okay, all right.
And the local language.
Mm-hmm.
Further, we depend heavily on the open source project Sugar. The Sugar user interface, mm-hmm. which you can learn more about at www.sugarlabs.org.
Mm-hmm. Is that something somebody could do remotely then to help you out?
Absolutely.
Okay.
The next thing is if someone could come up with a great framework for creating learning activities, simple interactive learning activities using JavaScript and HTML5.
But that's something that people are already working on, but you probably needed to step up your speed a little bit, huh?
Yeah.
It happens soon. Okay.
Just think about all those web frameworks, I mean, that you work with, Randall.
Yes.
You know that most websites do the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so a web framework abstracts most of that, so you can get to work on doing what's unique to that website.
Have you seen Dan Engel's Lively Kernel?
I've heard of it.
Yeah, we interviewed Dan on this show about a year ago, and it was really sort of interesting. It was full of, basically, it's the same thing with VToys, but running in JavaScript.
Okay.
Yeah, let's take a look at that. Maybe that'll help you out a little bit.
Okay.
Very
we really
cool
need
effort.
Simple animations,
mm-hmm.
But we really need our basically a Ruby on Rails-like thing that when you say create learning activity, it creates stubs for the lesson plan,
mm-hmm.
the assessment part. For the kids want to see it, hear it, do it, and if at all possible, collaborate with other kids.
Mm-hmm.
So having a stub for the navigation, for the help menus, for the assessment part where they can work with the ideas themselves.
Mm-hmm. So, Brian, is there anything that I skipped over that you really want to make sure our audience understands?
Things I hear about laptops in schools. People say that, well, we don't have we don't have laptops in rich countries. Why do we need them in poor countries?
Mm-hmm.
So my answer to that is that you don't need laptops in rich countries because you've got libraries. You've got one teacher for every 30 kids. You got mm-hmm. tons of books, and the kids have, for the most part, computers at home. Mm-hmm. They have lots of resources. So the laptop doesn't offer that much more resources.
But in your situation, it's night and day.
It's night and day. It's just the laptop offers a lot more resources, and that can be transformative in a lot of situations.
What about people that say that instead of spending the money on this program, they should upgrade the water delivery system or the sewer system?
I mean, should you buy shoes or a shirt?
Hmm.
You need both.
<It's true>. Well, Brian, it has been an absolute treat to be chatting with you. I appreciate you taking your time. I know it's late in the evening for you, and I appreciate you staying up so I could make this call this morning for me. It's an 11-hour and 45-minute difference or something like that. That's really strange. Why the odd time zone? That seems odd.
India is a half hour ahead instead of an hour. And Nepal has to be different than India, so they're 15 minutes ahead.
Nationalism, huh? I love it.
Yep. I want to say one more thing, Randall.
Please.
I just want to say thanks to a lot of the people that have, this project is doing well in a lot of countries because of a lot of selfless, passionate contributions from a lot of people around the world.
Mm-hmm.
Guys like Richard Smith, Richard Wadlington, Mary Lou Jepson, all the people at Sugar Labs, from Tomeo Vizoso, Walter Bender. There's a whole ton of people that I can't fit them all in. I just want to say thank you to them, and your contributions are really changing people's lives. And that's the power of open source.
Absolutely. Thank you very much. Brian Berry, CTO of Open Learning Exchange Nepal. Thank you for being on Floss Weekly.
Oh, thank you.
That's Brian Berry. I want to say ole, Nepal.
Ole, Nepal. That's ole. Pretty good. That's pretty good. So one of the couple things I just wanted to underline from that interview that was just really amazing is, I don't know if you caught this, but all of the bandwidth of these access points at the schools was being consumed not by the kids looking up Wikipedia, but they had to worry because the adults were surfing porn on it.
Oh, great.
So they had to put in filters for that. I don't know if you caught that.
Great. Does OpenDNS work in Nepal?
I hope so. Great. That's just pretty crazy. And I'm also amazed that they got to send the machines home with the kids.
Yeah.
I mean, I would think this is, and they get to keep them. And, they started in second grade. They're bringing them back for third grade now, because third grade is starting, I guess, next month. And it's just an amazing thing that there's this trust for the kids to take this home and keep using it at night and the weekends and all that sort of stuff. Just amazing stuff.
Well, don't you think, this is... You know, maybe 90% of the kids who do this, will enjoy it, but not continue on. But, 1 in 10 is going to get so turned on and is going to just be this is their life. They've mm-hmm. discovered something. And I think what an opportunity that they would not have had otherwise.
Absolutely. I mean, this brings them at parity with what we're doing here. In fact, in some ways.
I wish my kids had this opportunity.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, and if I had had ebooks instead of having to have hard copy books that I'd haul around, I'd be hauling around 10 times as many books, and I have access to all this information all the time, especially if you go online and in the Wi-Fi spot. So just amazing. And also I also want to reemphasize the calls for action that he said at the end, is that really people wanting to help with sugar, making sugar better, making courseware better, meta-courseware better, so it's easier to deploy new applications using like the new HTML5 and JavaScript and stuff. Really, if you're into that, we have the contact addresses in the show notes for this show. Just please help him out there. And that one last thing was, replacing him. He's leaving at the end of the year, as he said, and you don't need to know Nepali. You just need to have a willingness to come work on this project. And what an amazing opportunity for somebody.
There's a lot of people just go to Nepal just because they want to see this amazing country.
Absolutely.
This is a chance to also make a difference there.
And to get to work there. I would do this in a minute if I didn't have a lot of other things already in the fire. So
next week, speaking of the Far East, we're going to go Zen.
Indeed.
Zen Buddhism. X-E-N.
Nope. Oh, there's the tie. And I see Zen. It's almost all the same
get
thing.
It?
Yes.
Get it?
We have a number of upcoming guests that are very, very cool. We have Ian Pratt of the Zen Source, who... is all about virtualization, all about being able to make machines that act virtually on top of each other and virtualizing the hardware and stuff. This would be an example of something like, say, Amazon EC2 or VMware would do, that sort of thing, being able to layer it on top of other machines. We have him coming up next week. We have coming up a week after that, we'll have Cinelera, the open source video editing system.
We have OpenMoco coming up after that, the open source phone stuff that's still running on. You said your GPS runs with it, right?
Say again. I'm sorry.
Your GPS runs with OpenMoco? Is it?
Oh yeah, my Dash does.
Your Dash, right?
Yeah, that's, you know, and it's. I was very sad because, well, I wasn't surprised because it's such a hard thing to do open source hardware, but I was very sad because I thought this was a real great opportunity, and I love the Dash. But I'm glad the software is going to continue, even if the hardware won't.
Absolutely. So we're talking to him coming up in a couple of weeks. We're talking to the guys from Bug Labs, which is open source hardware, similar to Arduino like we had a few weeks ago. But this is a whole different group doing it. Some very cool hardware that I've seen them work with. We also have just added to the schedule, we have Tim O'Reilly, the O'Reilly man himself, the O'Reilly Media, used to be called O'Reilly O'Reilly and Associates Publishing House. They've published a couple of books that I think I might recognize, the ones with animals on the cover. So Tim has agreed to come on and talk about his contribution to open source over the years and kind of like where it's been, where it's going. I mean, it's Tim's one of Tim's books that he published that created the term open source. So,
oh, really?
You know,
yeah,
very
well,
cool.
Well, he coined the term Web 2.0. He's really been in the forefront of all of this stuff.
I'm really looking forward to that show. Yeah. I'm really happy that he's able to come on our program with that. We've got a number of other ones coming up after that. And again, if you want to see the schedule coming up in the future, you can go to twit.tv/floss. And now to send me suggestions, you have a new, much easier email address to remember. It's simply floss@twit.tv. Love it. It'll come right into my inbox, and you can tell me what you like about the show, tell me what you don't like, and suggest some future guests if you want to, or if you are one of the guests listed on our list and you want to be scheduled sooner, just let me know, and we can move you up into the schedule. So that's very cool. Speaking of schedule, I am going to be, as this show airs, I'm going to be at Linux Fest Northwest in Bellingham, Washington. I'll be there representing Linux Fund, which is the, as we talked about last week, I'm now a board member handing out money for open source software. So I'm really, that's an exciting sort of project for me to be working on. So I'm really happy with that. And as you're, if you want to see what I'm doing at Linux Fest Northwest, you can follow me on Twitter. That's twitter.com/Merlin with a Y. And I'll be Twittering all the way up and back and telling you what's actually going on. And also be in Minneapolis next week talking about open source software. So, you know me, the usual routine. It's Randall all over the map, as I usually am.
Well, Randall, I'm glad that every once in a while you light and do a Floss Weekly with us.
Mm-hmm.
It's great to talk to you every once in a while, every week. You've been very, very good about that.
Thanks, Leo.
Email Randall, floss@twit.tv. Don't forget your linux.org, linuxfund.org credit card. I saw you Twitter this.
Yep.
The old MasterCard is no good except in Canada. You're not helping Linux Fund, so you want to go get that new Visa card. Just go to linuxfund.org for more information. Mm-hmm. Help support open source projects all over the world.
Exactly.
And it costs nothing for you to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Randall. We'll see you next time on Floss Weekly.